Welcome to Whitley on Wine with your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist Robert Whitley.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, bejewel me, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry, peel me a grape.
Welcome to another week of Whitley on Wine. I'm your host, Robert Whitley.
And I'm Lisa Redwine from the Shores Restaurant.
You are co-host, Lisa Redwine. Yes. And today, Lisa, we're going to talk about one of what I understand to be your favorite topics.
Oh, I love champagne.
And the biggest myth about champagne is that not everything that bubbles is champagne.
No, no.
So many people, it doesn't matter what it is, if it has bubbles, they want to call it champagne. That's not necessarily a bad thing. At least they're drinking wine.
Exactly.
But, you know, the holidays are coming up, and there are a lot of parties, and we have New Year's Eve on the horizon, and that's the time of year that I start thinking about champagne, although I must admit that over the last 10 years or so, I have been more inclined to incorporate champagne into everyday activities. An aperitif, if friends are coming over, and serve it with, I love good champagne, you know, like vintage champagne,
right,
with scallops and lobster and things like that. So it's not just for a celebration, but the occasion of us talking about it today is because the end of the year, the New Year's Eve is coming.
Thank goodness. It's time to pop something open and off to a great 09.
So before we talk about some of the champagnes that we like, I know you have some of your favorites and mm-hmm. I have some of my favorites. And this week at Wine Review Online, we have a number of articles about champagne, and we'll get into some of that later. Let's talk about the different types of bubbly and different types of champagne. And let's start with champagne itself and explain what Brut is.
Okay. Well, Brut, you know, some people, they don't really understand what Brut is. And Brut's really a really dry champagne. When you see the word Brut, that really signifies the dryness level. And, you know, you do see Brut Natural or Extra Brut out there on the marketplace, but predominantly the most commonly seen is just Brut. And when you have it, know that it's going to be bone dry.
But what confuses everyone?
Oh, extra dry.
Is extra dry.
Absolutely.
So you think, well, that's going to be drier than Brut. But it's not.
No.
It's sweeter. It has a higher level of
residual sugar
in the dosage that mm-hmm. they put in the champagne.
You know, and that can be really misleading because you open it up and then you think, wow, it's, you know, perceptible. It's sweet. And that's not what people are often looking for when the perception of champagne is that it is very dry.
Sure. The extra dry champagnes, though, can be very nice. I mean, mm-hmm. The Moët & Chandon White Star is an extra dry, and it's the most popular champagne sold in the United States. And it is so popular that other big champagne houses have started to have their own little products that they put on the market that are slightly sweeter and a little rounder and not as acidic. You know, you don't have that apparent acidity.
Right.
And I know that's what bothers some people about really good champagne is that it's the structure of it is very acidic. And
too sour. I hear that every once in a while. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, but we love it.
Yes.
We love it. So, what would be your ultimate number one wish list champagne if we had an unlimited budget and I could say, you know, on behalf of the Whitley on Wine show, go out and buy your favorite, you know, your number one champagne and taste it and tell me what it was like.
96 Clos de Menil Krug.
Yeah.
Easy.
And that's going to run me, what, about $400?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Felicia, is she worth it?
$400? No, it's going to run you a little bit more.
A little
than
more
that.
Than that?
Oh, yeah. Put an extra zero at the end.
Well, what is Cristal? Cristal is about $400, right?
Yeah, Cristal is about $400. It's funny, you know, Cristal is really, you know, as a wine buyer, it's becoming a little bit more available. There was a time when, you know, it was almost unattainable. And now it's definitely, it's you see it a little bit,
so
more.
So in your opinion, why is Clos du Manil, the Krug vintage champagne, why is that so expensive?
Well, it's the history.
It's the rarity.
I mean, 96 was just an epic vintage. And then of course, Clos du Manil is just one of the most widely and highly regarded vineyards out there. So, you know, when you're looking at champagne, that's an important... It's an important thing. It's an important aspect to consider. You know,
okay,
what vineyard is it from, or
now let's change the parameters. How about a champagne that I can afford?
Okay, very easy again.
You can almost say Krug again with the Grand Cuvée.
Well, no, but I think people always ask me, you know, if I was, you know, going out to buy a bottle of really nice champagne, I'd go out and buy a bottle of Biacart Semillon Rosé.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, it's just it's a great house. It's really small, but consistently year over year, the rosé to me is beautiful.
You know, their rosé is good, and I really like it, and I think that's an excellent pick. But the rosé that has impressed me year in, year out, and it's not nearly as expensive, is the Laurent Perrier.
Oh, Laurent Perrier. You know, again, you know, there's over 400 houses and, you know, in Champagne, and here we talk so often about just a few of them. But Laurent Perrier, certainly in terms of quality level, is very consistent.
You know, and I just had the, I hate to say this, it's $300 a bottle. I just had the Perrier Jouet 2002 Fleur Rosé.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful wine. And I had it with the Domaine Carneros, which is owned by Tanninger from the Napa Valley. And you know, the difference in price is like, you know, one-tenth for the Domaine Carneros.
Right.
Very, very nice wine, but it just does not have the elegance and the complexity and the depth of the French champagne. And I think, you know, we both agree that sparkling wines from California have come a long way, and they're very good. And with some of them, you can close your eyes and it could be champagne. But by and large, the great champagnes kind of stand out.
But, you know, one thing that's really interesting about Domaine Carneros, I mean, Eileen Crane has certainly been one of my heroines for many years. And
she'd be happy to hear that.
I mean, she is just an amazing woman. And I've been up to Domaine Carneros many times and been out with Eileen and very fortunate to know her. But the thing that I really respect about her wines and her sparkling is that she really speaks to the terroir and the land and the style in which Domaine Carneros has become known for. So, you know, she's really created sparklings that reflect California.
Right.
And, you know, for me...
They're well-made wines.
There's
no question. They're beautiful wines.
Absolutely.
And invariably, you know, I score them, you know, when in my evaluations, always in the, you know, 90-point range.
Yeah.
You know, they're very, very, very good wines.
Well, and in terms of value, too, the Le Rêve, which is their top-of-the-line sparkling, has a fraction of the price of, you know, Krug Grand Cuvée or any of the other... You know, Comte de Champagne, but...
The Tanninger Comte de Champagne, which is so beautiful. Which would you rather have, though?
That's an unfair question.
You know, before we go any further, and before we wrap up, I want to say that we will have some very specific recommendations. But before we go any further, let's talk about some of the differences between champagne and other sparkling wines.
Right.
Before we went on the air, we were talking about Cremant. You know, I said that on my Whitley on Wine blog, I had recommended the Lucien Albrecht Cremant the Alsace, which is under $20 a bottle.
Right.
You know, the rosé is made from Pinot Noir. The Blanc is made from Pinot Gris, and these are lovely wines. But it's not champagne, but they're wonderful.
Right. Well, and you know, just because it's not champagne from the Champagne region, doesn't really indicate that it's any less enjoyable. And you know, for those who just drink champagne on New Year's Eve, I wouldn't recommend having Tattinger Comte de Champagne because, I mean, that's really, you know, you're taking money that, you know, you could spend it elsewhere on a nice bottle of wine that you might appreciate more. But there's some great sparklings out there from around the world that drink just as beautifully as champagne.
Do you like Prosecco?
I do. I like Prosecco. To me, Prosecco, I call it my afternoon wine.
Yeah.
I think it's a great thing, especially around this time of the year, like tomorrow, for example, when you're sitting down in the afternoon with family. It's a great way to start.
I agree with you. It tends to be very fruity, and I think of it as an aperitif wine,
right,
or a wine to serve with nice savory appetizers.
Mm-hmm. It's also really fun to make those wine-based cocktails with. You know, mm-hmm. it's a great thing to put in.
Because it has a lot of flavor, and it just doesn't disappear when you mix it with something.
In the summertime, you know, you can add fresh peach puree to it, or in the wintertime, you know, cranberry.
What about cava?
You know, cavas have really come along. The Montferrand is really quite good.
Yeah, and before we go any further, a couple of Proseccos that I really like. My number one Prosecco is Adami, A-D-A-M-I. Mm-hmm. Very, very good. And I also like one called Bisol, B-I-S-O-L. Mm-hmm. Very, very nice. Okay, cava. Tell us about cava.
Well, you know, cava is made method champenoise or method traditionnel, just as in champagne. Prosecco, you know, as we were talking about, they make it in a completely different way. So, of course, the fruitiness is retained. But in
Metodo Italiano,
yes,
they call it. Yes.
But, you know, cava is made in the same process as champagne. So mm-hmm. you get a lot of the very similar characteristics. The grapes can tend to vary, and depending on where it's grown and where it's made, that can play a role in it as well. But, you know, certainly it has those characteristics of the slight yeastiness.
Sure. Yeah.
You know,
the one thing, the big difference for me with cava when I compare it to champagne is it's much lighter. Mm-hmm. And that's because of the grape varieties they use.
Right.
It doesn't quite have the acid structure. So it's a much lighter and easier to drink sparkling wine than champagne.
But they're getting better and better. And yeah. I mean, I've been tasting.
Well, not that they're bad.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that they're different.
But you know, really, when you start, you know, it used to be, you know, growing up, everyone, we always get the black Frisianet bottle and sign it for Christmas, and it was.
What do they call that Cordon Negro?
Oh yes,
Frisianet.
Yeah. Oh, but you know, now there's a lot more boutique producers coming around, mm-hmm. and you know, the prices are. They're a little bit higher, but still, you know, they represent a good value as compared to champagne.
Well, you know, I like some of the sparkling wines from Franciacorta in Italy, namely Cato Bosco.
Yes.
But that's not inexpensive. I mean, those are champagne prices.
I was just at a tasting, and I was surprised with the pricing of those wines. But when I drank them, the mm-hmm. quality level was right there.
Yeah, I think Cato Bosco is right there with the top mm-hmm. champagne houses.
Absolutely.
It's a fabulous, fabulous product.
The only challenge is to convince other people mm-hmm. that it is. And most people don't, and I mean, unless you're really wine savvy. You know, yeah. Franciacorta isn't necessarily on the top of most people's wine
Most
wine
people
list.
Can't pronounce it. Yeah. You know, so, but at least, you know, those wines are not only made like champagne, but they use the traditional grapes mm-hmm. of champagne, whereas in cava,
right.
you have different grapes.
Right.
And in, Cremant d'Alsace, you have different grapes.
Right.
If you go to the Loire Valley where they make nice Cremants, then you have Chenin Blanc for the Blanc de Blanc, and you have Cabernet Franc or Pinot Noir
Absolutely.
For your rosés.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a different feel and a different flavor profile mm-hmm. just because they're using different grapes.
Well, and they really, you know, and the fun part is that they really pair with different types of food.
You mentioned a Cremant de Bourgogne that you like.
Oh, yeah, Perrigo Richard. Mm-hmm. Really inexpensive, delicious.
When you say inexpensive, give me a price.
Oh.
Roughly.
I would say under $25.
Yeah.
Retail.
Okay. That's good.
You know, it's not bad at all. I don't know where they would carry it retail. I've mm-hmm. Poured it by the glass before in San Diego, but it's one of those where to pour something under $20 a glass, it's really can be a challenge. And
yeah.
those Cremants de Bourgogne can be delicious. So
the one thing I would like to get back to champagne, and I want to talk about some of the champagnes that have impressed you this year mm-hmm. and that have impressed me. What really sets it apart for me is the depth, the structure, the complexity, the seriousness with which they make champagne. You know, some of the champagnes that I really like have been aged on the lees before disgorgement, you know, 7, 8, 9 years. And you just get a different level of complexity and structure that I really don't think can be replicated anywhere outside the chalky soils of Champagne.
I'd agree with that. I mean, it certainly when you bring terroir into the picture, you really can't replicate mm-hmm. replicate that soil. You know, and that really brings a lot to the structure of the wine and really to the ageability of the wine.
You know, and a case in point would be one of my pricier champagnes I'm going to recommend today. It's the Henriot in 1998, Brut Millésime, and that's $95 a bottle. But it was probably one of the two or three finest champagnes I tasted this year. Really a beautiful wine. And that's a wine that I would love to open or serve with dinner on New Year's Eve, because this is just, it's so memorable. This is just a fabulous wine, but aged 9 years on the lees,
right,
which is, you know, that contributes to the tremendous expense. You know, when you take a product out of circulation and you don't release it for 10 years after you've made it, you know, you have an investment there.
Right. And it's a gamble. You don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for maybe it's for some of our listeners, I mean, we talk a lot about aging on the lees. And one of the things that our guests always say is, well, what exactly does that do for the champagne? And what is it? So, I mean, maybe you want to.
Well, you have a process that happens in the bottle called autolysis, and that is simply the chemical changes that happen to the molecules in wine, and you develop earthy aromas. You'll get out of aged champagnes, you get a lot of earthy aromas like honey and mushrooms and nuts and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And these are complexities that for champagne connoisseurs, they really prize those. Younger champagnes can be just as pleasurable, but they will taste different. They
mm-hmm.
won't have those characteristics
right.
that come with that autolysis that happens over a long period of aging.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I know one of the biggest misconceptions out there too is that champagne goes bad, and really, you know, because of the high acidity, really they can age forever.
Age very well. You know, a couple of years ago, I had the 1964 Dom Perignon. Still beautiful.
Oh, absolutely.
Really a beautiful champagne. When I reviewed this 1998 Henriot Brut Millésime, you know, my comment was that it has another 10, 12 years on the cork. And so, you know, when it's aging before they've disgorged it, it's not on the cork, it's on a cap.
Right.
And it's in contact with the yeast cells. And when they disgorge it, they get rid of the yeast and they put a cork in it, a real cork. And, you know, there's a theory that once it goes on the cork, the aging process you know, it's quicker.
Right.
And it is to some extent, but the really great champagnes will age very, very well. So this 98 Henriot, I believe, you know, will still be good 10 years from now. I mean, not just good, but really fabulous. I like another Henriot champagne that did very well this year. It was the Best of Show Sparkling Wine at the San Diego International Wine Competition. And it's their Blanc de Blanc. It's their multi-vintage Blanc Souverain, which retails for about $65 a bottle. Really, just a lovely champagne. And we were talking before about multi-vintage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people think if it doesn't have a vintage on it, that it means it's lesser. But I have a couple here that are just fabulous, like the Cru Grand Cuvée, which retails for about $125 a bottle. That's a multi-vintage Tête de Cuvée champagne,
right.
which means it's their creme de la creme. And also, I really love at you know, a little under $70, the Gossette Grand Reserve Brut. And also this lovely Tanager Prelude that I brought you, which is not only a multi-vintage, but all of the vineyards that provide the grapes for this champagne are Grand Cru vineyards. So you have Grand Cru and you have Premier Cru. Grand Cru is the top level. This is made from 100% Grand Cru, and this retails for about $70 a bottle.
Have you seen this available retail in San Diego?
I don't know about San Diego, but I've seen it in restaurants.
Right.
And that's unfortunate. A lot of times the really rare products only show up in restaurants.
Right.
But you're in the restaurant business, so that's good for you.
It's not so bad for me, no.
And then, you know, in the more affordable category, I have been so impressed with Mum Cordon Rouge the last 5-6 years since Dominique de Marville became mm-hmm. their chef de cave, and he really turned the program around, used better reserve wines in the non-vintage Brut, which retails for about $35 a bottle. Mum at one time was a big, big brand here in the United States,
right.
and I think that they quality fell off a little bit, and they lost some of their shine, but they've gotten it back. Unfortunately, Dominique has left Mum, and he's now at Veuve Clicquot, but the program that he installed, that he put in place, is carrying on. And another kind of comeback story like that is Piper Heidsieck. I think the Piper Heidsieck non-vintage Brut, same thing. They've started to put more of their better reserve wines in the non-vintage Brut and kind of pumped up the quality. And in that $25 to $30 range, which is very hard to find,
mm-hmm.
a good non-vintage Brut champagne. Piper Heidsieck is probably about the top wine at that price point.
You know, what's really interesting too is that when you start looking at champagnes, you forget about about those. As we were talking mm-hmm. earlier, I can't remember the last time I had mom Cordon Rouge. It's one of those brands that's out there. You see it all the time, and you forget how good they can be.
And, you know, it's one of the things I like about it is it does a very good job of mimicking a vintage champagne because it's big and yeasty and powerful. It has a lot of depth. This is really a classy non-vintage brew. And then, of course, you and I both have a now, this is a little more expensive. It's going to be in the $40, $45 range. But the Paul Roger non-vintage brew or Brut Reserve is just a
It's always a classic.
It's a to die for. Yes. The elegance of that wine is just extraordinary.
Well, it's really, I find it to be very balanced. It's the acidity's layer. It's, you know, the bubbles are always really nice and small, tiny. Mm-hmm. There's just a great, there's a great finesse with that wine. The finish is there. It's got a little backbone and structure to it, but... it's not overwhelmingly.
You know, one of the things I like to tease a little bit about the Paul Roger. It's one of those wines that whenever we finish the last drop, I want to cry. You know, more, and that's one where if you lay your hands on a Magnum as opposed to a 750. Oh. All the better. And you'll be surprised. You know, you look at it and you say, well, you know, that's too much wine for two people.
No.
No, it really goes down easy. What are some of the champagnes that, that you've had in the recent past that you would throw out there as good to go look for?
You know, funny enough, I just was out with a bunch of ladies for lunch the other day, and we had the Bruno Paillard Rosé. Now, again, you know, it's one of those brands, you see it all the time, but yet when you buy it, you generally aren't tasting it. So we were at lunch, and it was a beautiful bottle of rosé. It was kind of a little bit of a, you know, apple strawberry nose to it, great acidity, juicy, and like you say, easy to drink. All of a sudden, my allocated two glasses were gone.
And you were like, more.
I'd like to have more. The other wine that I really enjoy is one, it's a little bit harder to find. Again, it's very, it's in that $20 to $22 price range, but it's from the Loire, and it's a sparkling Saumur, Louis de Grenouille. And it is, it's a little richer, it's a little bigger. Mm-hmm. And just because it's sparkling doesn't mean it necessarily goes with everything. So as you're looking at more of the heartier dishes, you know, prime rib or some of the steaks that you see for New Year's Eve, it can be a great pairing as well.
Sure. Well, you know, that you bring up a good point. When I'm in Champagne, and I usually make one trip a year, although this year I passed, I cut back on my travel a little bit, but if you're out in a good restaurant in the Champagne region, it's not uncommon at all to have a rosé champagne, you know, a vintage rosé mm-hmm. champagne, something with some power and some substance and some depth
structure,
to it,
right?
To have it with meat.
Oh, absolutely. You know, about 4 years ago, I was lucky enough to do Cam Schramsberg. Mm-hmm. Holly Peterson Mondavi did the food and wine pairing for it. Mm-hmm. And we paired multiple courses, different types of dishes, everything from appetizers to salads to main courses, with sparkling from Schramsberg. And the interesting part was that as we were going through the tasting profiles, you know, the saying out there is champagne goes with everything. And what we found is that indeed it doesn't. And it, certainly you can find something sparkling that will match with everything, but just depending on what that dish is, it's going to really make a big difference as to what type of sparkling
you put. I agree. And I also think with aperitifs, you want a little lighter champagne.
Absolutely.
You know, something like, you know, I hear the music coming up. So
I think we're
out of time. Todd, are you telling me we're down to like 30 seconds or something? Well, that's all we have time for. Lisa, I want to thank you for your help today, and I want to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And after the first of the year, I want to know what you opened on New Year's Eve.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. That's all we have time for this week. This is Robert Whitley for Whitley on Wine, saying until next week,